outdated and sexist dress codes in local schools have now sparked a federal complaint. Good Thursday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Alyssa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we'll tell you why St. Johns County schools are now facing a Title IX complaint after altering yearbook photos of girl students without their consent. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, a conversation with PBS travel host Rick Steves. Travel is back, and you can join him tonight, courtesy of WJCT. But our top story this morning, the feds are now looking into that yearbook flap in St. Johns County. The U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights is investigating the St. Johns County School District for potential violation of federal statutes for its dress code policy. And this complaint is based on gender bias. The images of female students in the Bartram Trail High School yearbook were photoshopped this year without their consent to cover up chests and shoulders. News of the controversy made national, even international headlines. Reporter Colleen Jones is covering the story for the St. Augustine Record, and she's on the line with the latest. Colleen, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And what are your questions, everyone, about Title IX, dress codes in schools, and this complaint against St. Johns County schools over the Bartram yearbook? Give us a call, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect at wjct.org. Tweets to at Melissa Injax. And our Facebook page is open, too. Well, Colleen, before we get into the latest news on this, which you have been following, let's begin by explaining how this all began for people who haven't been following this story, how this whole controversy flared up at Bartram Trail High School.
Yeah. So, you know, the yearbook complaint was really based on a pushback that has begun, last fall into this spring, where the dress code came under scrutiny by many parents and students who've been working, trying to convince administrators to take another look at the dress code policy, which they claim has wording that they believe is sexist. Words used in the policy like distracting, immodest, too revealing, that are targeting young women and not young men. So when the yearbooks came out, some of these young women went to school, took their photos, probably earlier this year in January, and thought everything was just fine until they opened their yearbooks and saw photos that they did not recognize of the dress that they were wearing that they went to school with that day. They were not dress coded, basically the term they used for being called out by administrators to have measurements taken of skirts that could be too above the knee, shoulders being shown, spaghetti straps, things like that. And so that really set off what was already a movement amongst the St. Johns County school community to take a larger look at this issue. There was a lot of emotional reaction. There was anger, really, especially on the part of the students who felt violated for their images being altered.
Right. An advisor to the yearbook students, the kids that put out the yearbook, on her own volition, she photoshopped these images of female students. And as I mentioned, it made headlines around the world. When you looked at the photoshopped images, it was pretty incredible because on the left side, you'd see an image of a girl with a tiny bit of cleavage or a tiny bit of exposed shoulder. And then on the photoshopped image, it was completely covered up.
Yeah. They actually photoshopped pieces of clothing and in some cases pretty sloppily. It wasn't even a well done job. And apparently this yearbook advisor who we've been trying to get on the record, she has not agreed to talk to anyone in the press. The word is from the district that she kind of went rogue and did this apparently on her own, made this decision on her own. And again, everyone, including the students that were targeted with the altered photos, were unaware until they opened up their yearbooks that day.
So tell us about the latest news, Colleen. The complaint filed by parent Nancy Trey, and it's based on a Title IX statute. Of course, Title IX protects people from discrimination based on sex in education programs, any education program that receives federal assistance. So what's the nature of the complaint?
Well, basically, it says that, I'm paraphrasing here, that the dress code has unfairly targeted female students, and this is, again, based on what was filed by the parent, Nancy Trey, that the female students who have been targeted have been publicly humiliated. And by that, I mean, in March 29th, there was a large-scale inspection, let's call it a sweep, of the hallways in Bartram Trail High School, where female students were one by one, as they walked down a hallway, asked to step aside in front of their peers and do things like hold their arms up over their heads to see where their clothing fell, if it covered their midriff. They were asked to go into a private room with administrators and reveal what was underneath, in some cases, like a zip-up coat or some kind of another layer to see if they had sports bras underneath. I guess the idea being that they could possibly throughout the day remove one of those layers of clothing and then be, you know, in violation of showing too much skin. So, you know, this really has brought a lot of outrage from parents and from students who have shown up over probably the last 3 months to school board meetings, some very emotional comments that students have made wearing some of the same clothing that they said was dress coded, and talking about how, you know, the dress code is, the district says, meant to not distract young men in their bodies, in young women's bodies being shown, but these young ladies say that being taken out of class, taken out of their instructional time, is distracting to them in their academic careers.
Right. I mean,
and it makes them feel like they're developing bodies are the problem.
And of course, St. John's County is by far from the only school district to be accused of enforcing a sexist and outdated dress code policy. This is a problem all over the country, Colleen. This policy is sending the message, critics say, to the female students that their bodies are inherently sexual, and that and what else? The other complaint about this is that there's such selective enforcement. It's almost always girls who are dress coded, not boys. And so both the boys and the girls are being sent the message that all of the onus is on the girls to cover up.
That's right.
And the boys aren't being told, control yourself, behave yourself. That's the issue, I think, that has so outraged parents and students.
And I think a lot of this has come to play because of the Me Too movement. I mean, I've talked to some experts about dress code sexism, and you know, there have been a lot of cases similar to this across the country where school districts are being asked to get with the times and rewrite your codes and don't use verbiage that again, you know, uses words like immodest, because again, it implies that young women are somehow trying to call attention to their own bodies and that they should cover them up in some way.
And of course, with the Bartram Trail yearbook, it was pointed out that there were boys pictured in the yearbook in wearing nothing but a Speedo. Yeah, I guess they were on the swim team. And that wasn't photoshopped. I'm not sure, but you would know more than I would.
They were not... you know, the individual student shots, but apparently photos with Speedos were shown, I guess, of the men's swim team. Yeah, so. But yeah. It is a stark comparison. You know, I think that one of the problems, too, when you talk about the dress code being sort of selective, is also in its enforcement that, you know, all of this stuff happened at Bartram Trail, at least what we know about it. But, you know, that principal was called to task for, you know, the way that this all was handled and the way that that large-scale inspection in the hallways, you know, embarrassed students. But yet we're not hearing some of the same complaints that other middle, high school, even elementary schools. And so I think that parents are calling for more consistency also in the way that whatever codes are finally decided upon are enforced. And there is an effort to put together a broad-based community of district leaders, principals, parents, and students charged with making revisions to the district code, as soon as next school year they might go into effect.
We're speaking with reporter Colleen Jones of the St. Augustine Record. A Title IX complaint has come down against St. Johns County Schools over photoshopped images in a high school yearbook. 549-2937. Janet in St. Augustine. Hello, Janet. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I am a retired teacher from St. Johns County Elementary.
And if you could turn your radio down, Janet, that would help.
Okay, so sorry.
That's okay.
I enjoy your program.
Thank you.
So I am a retired teacher, and I don't think that you could come up with a better example supporting school uniforms in our schools. I know that the parochial schools have had school uniforms probably since the beginning, and I don't think it has affected those children's psyche in a negative way. I think they probably are proud of their school and their school uniforms. So I support the idea of having school uniforms, and to tell high school, middle school boys to control themselves is laughable.
They're punished for fighting. They're punished for skipping school. They're punished for all manner of infractions. I mean, there are clear rules about what's acceptable behavior in schools.
Well, yes, indeed. Indeed so. But the sexual thing is just that this is when these kids' hormones are raging, of course.
Well, the girls' hormone, but my point, Janet, is the girls' hormones are raging too.
So
what I'm saying is there's never this concern about girls lusting after the boys and behaving inappropriately. We just assume that the girls will behave themselves. Why can't we make the same assumption of the boys? Why can't we set a standard?
I think you might want to ask some of the boys about that, because the girls are certainly, if you want to use the word lusting after them. And it's just this isn't something new.
I know as a teacher, you've lived this. So I really do appreciate you sharing your perspective. And I know how difficult it is to manage kids that age, believe me.
And you with the young children, or I guess they're in middle / high school.
Well, yeah, we've got a high school graduate now and a high school going to be a sophomore. But Janet, I appreciate the call. I want to ask Colleen what you're about your points. So Colleen, certainly some advocates think uniforms are a solution. Well, the point I was getting at was that, we've raised two daughters in our home, so we've also seen the selective enforcement up close. And it's almost always girls who are sent home to change. And that has happened in our household. And there were certainly some times when I thought, I cannot believe that they felt that outfit was somehow not appropriate, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where in some cases, the boys' shorts can rise to the level above their knees that, it just goes sort of, unobserved. They're just athletic shorts, and, it's very, it's just sort of arbitrary. And I'll tell you, I have a 13-year-old son in middle school here in St. Johns County, and he, for one, and some of his friends have told me, as I've been covering this story, that they're actually offended by the dress code policy, that they think it's really ridiculous that their female classmates are being targeted in this way, and they actually, to that point about they're not being able to control themselves. I mean, my son says, what, a shoulder is going to distract me in math class? It's insulting, I think, to the boys as well, you know, what some of the other parents are saying.
Anne tweets the show, my daughter was dress-coded in Duval County in middle school for the length of her shorts. They were not out of code. I never bought anything she couldn't wear to school. Guy in St. Augustine. Hi, Guy. Good morning.
Good morning. I was shocked a few months back when my son, who was a senior last year at Bertram Trail, came home and told me that in his English class, the same teacher that did the photoshopping, cut without permission one of the guy's hairs, a lock of his hair, and taped it to a girl's test paper, apparently, because he was paying too much attention to her. So she would have something, you know, it would be on her paper that she had some of his hair. And
that's crazy.
Nobody said anything. Absolutely crazy. I said, Guy, you should have gone to the principal and reported the incident. And he didn't want to make a thing out of it. And I think a lot of kids that have been harassed that way and asked to actually jump up and down to see whether the girls had the proper bra on and whether anything bounced. If my daughter had this problem when she was in school, I would have been irate.
Yeah, and, sure. That's a crazy story, Guy. Thank you for that.
Well, it's the same teacher that did the photoshopping.
Okay. And certainly we have no way of verifying that. As you pointed out, Colleen, that teacher is not speaking publicly. Lots more tweets. Gregory tweets the show. I'm a teacher in Jacksonville. Dress codes apply to everyone. Boys push the boundary, too. There have been times when I've had to tell them to put their shirt on. The problem in St. John's County is they gave the boys a pass and clamped on the girls. Amy tweets us, I'm a former Catholic school student. Oh, Amy, I know exactly where you're going with this. She says, I can assure you that uniforms do not prevent dress code problems. We hemmed up our skirts or rolled them up to make them shorter and more stylish. So Colleen Jones, with all of this said, what could be the outcome of this Title IX complaint? What can we expect out of this?
Yeah, that's actually something that we're trying to follow up on now. Calls to the school district have really resulted in just a very basic response that we are complying with the OCR, the you know, the Department of Education Office of Civil Rights complaint, and they have 15 days to do so. They have 15 days to turn around data, submit data and interviews, and possibly have an on-site visit and interviews with staff. But, you know, we don't know yet, or at least the district won't tell us what decision could be made and, you know, what, if any, punitive measures or remedial measures to revise code that they might be forced to take.
But you have reported that in other parts of the country, these judgments around potential Title IX violations have forced schools to change dress code policies that are seen as discriminatory, right?
Yes, that's definitely an outcome that could come down. Yeah, and one of the cases that I reported on was a charter school in North Carolina had its policy challenged, and this is in the case of actually uniform, where girls were forced to wear skirts or jumpers, and then they were not allowed to wear shorts or pants like the boys. That needed to be changed, and their Department of Education for that state did require so. We don't know how Florida may treat this. It's, again, something that we're following up on to see what would be the next steps, you know, and how this investigation will move forward.
We'll follow it, too. And thank you for your reporting, Colleen Jones, with the St. Augustine Record. Thanks.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Later in the hour, how you can get a job. We'll speak with the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. But up next.
We owe it to our neighbors to get healthy and get vaccinated. And then when we do travel again, I think it's kind of exciting. I'm hoping there's a corona bonus that comes out of this.
PBS travel host Rick Steves on getting back out on the road again. And how you can join our conversation with him tonight. That's next. Well, Rick Steves is a popular public television host, a best-selling author, and an outspoken activist, encouraging all of us to broaden our perspectives through travel. We invite you to join WJCT Public Media tonight for an evening with Rick Steves. This is a virtual event. In the meantime, I got a preview from Rick about what drives his passion for travel. Take a listen. Rick Steves, a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, too, Melissa.
I am a longtime fan of your work, not just what you do on television, but also your guidebooks and everything you do to promote travel and bring the world closer together. So it's exciting that you're doing this event with WJCT this week, because as we sort of come out of the pandemic, the one thing I hear over and over again from people is, I just can't wait to travel again. I want to go somewhere. And it makes me wonder, have you been going anywhere, or have you been locked down too?
I've been locked down too. I've amazed myself, given how much I love to travel and how much I need to travel, how patient I've been. Hmm. You know, I've just decided this pandemic is God's way of telling us to slow down. For me, it's kind of therapy for a workaholic. It's a chance just to take a breath and to remember that there's more important things to life than my trip, the next travels I want to enjoy. And it's really reminded me that we got to take care of our community. We've got to embrace the science of this. We owe it to our neighbors to get healthy and get vaccinated. And then when we do travel again, I think it's kind of exciting. I'm hoping there's a corona bonus that comes out of this, and that we travel a little more mindfully, a little more thoughtfully, intending to get out of our comfort zone and get to know the other 96% of humanity and get ready for a future where the major challenges to our society and our safety are going to be challenges that are, impervious to conventional weaponry and blind to borders and really involve nations working together. I'm really kind of excited about it. So I've been doing a lot of thinking about that, and I know the light's at the end of the tunnel. We will be traveling again soon, but right now I'm just determined to work in my community here and make sure people are together rather than divided, and that we're all safe and healthy.
You've done amazing work to bring people together in your career. And it's interesting that you note that, the virus is borderless. Certainly this pandemic has taught us that.
Right.
But when you think about how we can travel more mindfully coming out of this, what are some examples of that do you think you might be doing and talking about?
Well, I really love the notion that the world is not a pyramid with the United States on top and everybody else trying to figure it out. I was raised thinking that, and until well into my adulthood, that's how I saw the world. But the beautiful thing about traveling is when you travel, you get out of your comfort zone. And a lot of people try to avoid culture shock. They think of culture shock as the enemy. But culture shock is the growing pains of a broadening perspective. I've had a lot of culture shock, and I relish the culture shock. Mm-hmm. It lets me gain an empathy for the other 96% of humanity and come home with what I think is the most beautiful souvenir. And that's a broader perspective. So, that's kind of, to me, a thoughtful approach to travel. And it took me a while to realize that. And that's something I teach, because I've got this platform where I write guidebooks and I lead tours and I produce a TV show. And I just love to challenge people to travel in a way where they, I guess the thing is, ironically or counterintuitively, in so many ways, when you leave home, you can learn more about your home by looking at it from a distance and seeing it in a different context.
What has been the most, I guess, eye-opening experience for you in all of your travels where you realized how the rest of the world sees us ugly Americans,
Well, yeah, it's, ugly Americanism is an interesting thing. It's not just Americans that are ugly, and it's not a condemnation. It's just a recognition that if you live in a big culture, it's easy to be ethnocentric. And, when you travel a lot, certain countries are famous for having people who are ugly in that sense. They are ethnocentric. They think their way is the norm. And the United States is certainly big, and a lot of Americans think we are the norm. In fact, a lot of Americans think we are exceptional, and that, to me, kind of loopy. There's ugly Germans, there's ugly Russians, there's ugly Indians, there's ugly Chinese. Those are the big cultures. And in Europe, all of those people are famous for traveling like they are the norm. Mm. They trample insensitively local standards without even knowing it. And it's a little bit off-putting. So, you know, I think part of the mark of a good traveler is somebody who is like a cultural chameleon, and they morph with each culture. And if people are talking softly, they talk softly. If people are drinking tea, they drink tea. If people eat their dinner late, they eat their dinner late.
Yeah.
I love that. If people clasp their hands together and bow slightly and say namaste, I like to do that. If people kiss you on the cheek, I'm all over that, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the fun thing about travel. I think you asked me what were the big, perspective-changing events, the eurekas in my travels. I think it was probably on my very first trip. I was 14 years old. My parents took me to Norway to see the relatives, and I was in a park behind the palace in Oslo, and my parents were just loving me, and they were going to great personal sacrifice in their travels and their economics to take their kid to Europe. And I just thought, that's in a powerful love, and I'm sort of the center of their life. And then I looked out over the park, and it was speckled with other families, with parents loving their children as much as my parents loved me. And it hit me right then, as a little 14-year-old, that this world is home to literally billions of equally lovable little children like me, and their parents just love the heck out of them. Later on in that same trip, I was on the carpet in front of the TV at my cousin's home in Bergen in Norway, and we were watching the Apollo moon landing, and Neil Armstrong, step onto the moon for the first time. And even as a little 14-year-old kid, it occurred to me, back home, all my friends are waving American flags and thinking this is an American celebration. Here I was in Norway, and we were just as excited. And it occurred to me, this is a human celebration. The entire planet was tuned in, and I listened to the broadcast in Norwegian, and leaped a skrifta for menneskeheten, and a giant leap for mankind.
Mm.
And it really had a lasting impact. And those are the things that have helped me have what I consider a broader global perspective. And I think it's a very important dimension of who I am. And it's my mission as a travel teacher to equip and inspire Americans to, I like to say, venture beyond Orlando, get out there and try something new.
Yeah, absolutely. I DVR shows that I love, and yours is one of them. And in this pandemic, I've rewatched a lot of Rick Steves Europe on Jack's PBS, so I can travel around the world without ever leaving my home, which your show does a fantastic job of. Let me ask you, I know you are committed to sustainability efforts in your travels. As the world gets more and more serious about addressing climate change, that is going to change the travel business quite a bit. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah. Well, I think you can flight shame yourself out of traveling because to save the environment, which is an option. But I think that's not the most constructive way to deal with this problem. We have to acknowledge that anybody in travel, especially me, I'm a tour organizer. I take 30,000 Americans to Europe on my tours every year outside of COVID. And, we contribute a lot to climate change with our carbon. And what I want to do is have my carbon taxed. Our government does not tax carbon. I tax myself for my carbon. In 2019, we recognized that taking 30,000 people on a 1,200 different Rick Steves bus tours, that adds a lot of carbon. And what I read and studied was that you can mitigate the carbon you create by investing in things that are good for fighting carbon. I believe in mitigation. If you create, this much bad, you can create that much good, and it zeroes it out. So it costs $30 per traveler flying from the United States to Europe and back to mitigate the carbon they create by flying that way. And I just gave myself this self-imposed carbon tax of $30 per person times 30,000 people. That's $900,000. I made that too much money. I should have paid for that in my bottom line in my accounting, but we don't tax people for that cost. And then I rounded it up to $1 million. The conventional thing for an American company to do that has a green ethic would be to buy carbon offsets. But I wanted to have kind of a twofer. I wanted to invest in the third world, in the developing world, the poor world, the half of humanity where the average daily income is $5, and people own a little patch of land and they farm. And I wanted to help those people do their work more efficiently and in a way that was less contributing less to climate change, because small, poor, third world or developing world farmers contribute a lot to climate change with the carbon they produce. And there are low-hanging fruit ways for, with a little coaching, a little help, that they can do their work more productively and much more less damaging to the environment. So we invested $100,000 in each of 10 different farming and forestry organizations in the developing world, and we created this portfolio. And what we were able to accomplish with that money generated by our self-imposed carbon tax was so inspiring, and we're doing it again every year. This is part of my ethic as a tour promoter, and I've created this program. It's called our Climate Smart Initiative. It's on my website at ricksteves.com. And at the very top, I challenge any other tour company to steal this program. Don't credit me, and just get ethical about paying your way when it comes to the carbon that the travelers that we take and make money off of. It contributes to climate change, and we need to mitigate that. So that's one step. It's not heroic. I don't brag about it. It's just the right thing to do. We're not doing any plus. It's just we're mitigating the negative.
Setting a great example. So, yeah. Rick Steves, I have to ask you this. I have this idea in my mind that you've been everywhere, but nobody, I guess, has really truly been everywhere. What's on your travel bucket list? Where do you want to go that you haven't been yet?
Well, you know, I've spent 100 days a year in Europe until COVID hit, every year since I was a kid, traveling, researching, making mistakes, taking notes, writing my guidebooks, leading my tours, making my TV shows, and so on. It's a wonderful ride. So you'd think I'd be really, really, really well-traveled. But my business is Europe. That's my beat. Europe, for me, is the springboard for world exploration for Americans. That's where I'm trying to get people to go. And I go back to Europe again and again and again. So I spend 100 days a year in Europe. And I'm comfortable with the places I know in Europe. And now my job is just to be right up to date on Europe. So I'm not as well-traveled as you would think. I've traveled a fair amount in Asia. My favorite country is India. I love Southeast Asia. I love Japan. I love traveling in Central America. My son lives down in Colombia in South America. So there's lots of great places to travel. But I'm kind of a workaholic. I've got a mission. I've got 100 people on my staff. And we are just laser-focused on helping Americans travel in Europe smartly and more thoughtfully. And I'm so thankful as a teacher, a travel teacher, to have the platform in public television where we can make these shows. Next on my, if you're going to call it a bucket list, would be, where am I going to teach? How am I going to share with my American audience my love of travel, specifically in Europe? When COVID hit, we had all the permissions and the crew booked and the flights and everything, the script, to make 2 new shows in Poland and 2 new shows in Iceland. Of course, we had to cancel that, so that'll be high on the docket. Also, I'm working on a series that I've been dreaming about for 20 years since we produced our TV show, and it's going to be my magnus opus, or what do you call it, opus magnum, or whatever, the big project. And that's going to be an art series, Europe's Art and Architecture. Europe's Art and Architecture is going to be 6 one-hour specials, and we're well into that now, and that's going to be my project for the next couple of years. So we got lots of fun travels ahead of us. My daughter's getting married, and I want to take her fiancé and their extended fiancé's family on one of our bus tours, and that's what the big heartbreak for me last year was. I had to cancel that, but we had 25 people all set up. I was going to get to know Jackie's new husband and his family, and my son Andy was going to be the tour guide, and I was going to go on a Rick Steves bus tour, doing what you're supposed to do on a bus tour, just relaxing with friends and having a good time. I've never done that. I've heard it's really nice, and we were going to take our flagship tour, the best of Europe in 20 days around Europe, and I was so excited about that, but we had to cancel it. But then I reminded all my friends, didn't cancel it, we just delayed it, and it's looking now, with the trajectory that we're on, that we'll be traveling again safely with our whole bus tour industry and so on by early 2022.
How fantastic. How lucky are they to get to make good on that? Well, it's a pleasure, and I'm so glad to speak with you, and I encourage everyone to go to our website, wjct.org/events. Join us tonight for an evening with Rick Steves. He is, of course, the host of Rick Steves Europe on Jax PBS and Travel with Rick Steves on 89.9 FM. He'll join our CEO, David McGowan, tonight for a conversation about his travels and his advocacy. Rick Steves, Great to talk to you. Thanks.
I'm looking forward to the event tonight, and thank you very much. Happy travels.
Well, the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association has a message. They're hiring. This week, they announced GreatFloridaJob.com. It's a new website you can use to post and find jobs across all levels of the state's hospitality industry. Nicole Chapman is the regional director and Florida Inns chapter director with the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. Hi, Nicole.
Good morning, Melissa.
So tell us about the jobs that are out there, because, of course, people want to get back to work, and a lot of businesses need workers.
Absolutely. So on Great Florida Job, it's a website we created specifically for the hospitality industry. There's every type of job on there, from entry level to managerial. So lots of different opportunities for anyone looking for a great place to work.
Right. And of course, the hospitality industry has been devastated by the pandemic. We're talking travel, tourism, hotels, restaurants, bars. This is about 1 million people around the state that were furloughed or laid off. What are you hearing from this cohort of workers? Because we are seeing a mismatch between businesses that can't find workers and workers that can't find the right job. So how do you hope to bridge that gap?
Absolutely. It definitely is a job seeker's market right now, with so Amazon and Home Depot and Lowe's hiring so many folks at the beginning of the pandemic. We hope that our industry peers that went those ways are itching to come back to hospitality. It's definitely a fun industry to interact with guests, and no day is ever the same. So we're hopeful that we can attract some new talent to the industry from the hotels, like you mentioned, the hotels, the bars, the restaurants. It's just a fun industry to work in with flexible hours for our employees.
Right. And we have seen a lot of businesses paying more per hour, offering all kinds of incentives to lure workers back. Tell us more about that trend.
Absolutely. So definitely when it's a job seeker's market, rates go up no matter which industry you're in. So I think across the jobs out there that are available, we are seeing higher wages now more than ever. Some businesses out there are hiring and doing incentives. For if you start with them, after 30, 60, 90 days, you get somewhat of a bonus. Another program that's working really well for our restaurants and hotels is the referral program. So if a current staff member knows a friend or a colleague that's interested to come join them, both get an incentive there, and that's working really well, too. It's always fun when you get to work with your friends.
And, you know, unemployment checks at the federal level are ending in the state. We've looked a lot at that because some have felt that the reason workers aren't coming back is because they could earn more just by picking up a check rather than going back into jobs. When you talk to workers, sometimes, though, they say there are a variety of reasons. Maybe they can't find childcare, or maybe they're worried about getting the virus if they're working a restaurant job. So from the perspective of Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, what are you saying to the labor force out there that are dealing with, you know, a whole slew of issues related to how they can get back to work?
Absolutely. And I want to tell them that we are listening. Our businesses are listening. So you'll see more flexible schedules than ever before. Maybe it's not 5 days in a row. It's maybe on and off different schedules to accommodate families that have childcare needs. So we're seeing more flexibility, different hours, different pay rates. A lot of times that there's some businesses out there on the restaurant side that pay daily. So if you do have to pay childcare, you can easily pay them at the end of the day and not have to wait for that paycheck at the end of the week. And we're very hopeful when those extra benefits end that we will see workers return to the industry and excited to get back to work and know that we are keeping our folks safe. We've got lots of different vaccination programs out there to encourage our staff and our businesses to vaccinate their staff.
Right. I mean, getting the state to at least 70% vaccinated, I'm sure that's something you'd like to see at your organization, right?
Absolutely. We are definitely, it's what businesses want. We want folks to feel comfortable and have that consumer confidence as they go out, as the guests go out, and as workers come back to work.
Now, you've even created a task force to work on this problem, because this is a big economic driver for the state. Did the task force come out with any recommendations?
Absolutely. This is this website, this great part of job, okay, was one of our recommendations of not having a job portal for just our industry specifically. So lots of ideas, and it's really an information sharing session when we're on these task force calls. What's working in South Florida might not work in the Panhandle, but it's always great to hear different ideas for the different, since we are such a vast state.
Now, if you go to this website, greatfloridajob.com, you can post a job, you can find a job. This is statewide,
absolutely,
right? Right, Nicole? This is jobs all over the state, and it's free to,
absolutely,
free to members?
It's free to our members to post, and it's absolutely free to anyone looking for a job. It's, the great thing is you can post by type. You can search by type of job, area of the state, and all those different things. So it's pretty user-friendly.
I just clicked on Jacksonville at greatfloridajob.com. Prati Italia has listed some jobs. They are hiring people. In fact, they've listed all of the jobs on your website for Jacksonville. Prati Italia and Town Hall, they're owned by the same group. So that's just one example. Mainly restaurant jobs, or does it kind of go across the sector? What are you seeing?
It goes
posted
across the sector. We're encouraging members every day to post. I know that many of our resorts up in Amelia Island and down the coast have definitely openings. We're just encouraging them to post. Sometimes it takes a minute for them to get that. We also have got some around the region. So there's St. Augustine, Amelia Island, Orange Park. All the places around us have openings, so people don't have to travel too far to find that perfect job.
When you talk to hotels and restaurants dealing with these historic labor shortages, that's got to be stressful for these managers and owners as well. What are you hearing from that side of the ledger?
Absolutely. It's very challenging. They're really excited when they get folks signed up for interviews and excited to bring on board, and then they get a no-show or they get a call out. So they're frustrated as well. We have such a demand here in Northeast Florida for people wanting to head to our hotels and to our restaurants. So the demand is there, just sometimes the staffing's not. So as you're seeing signs out there that say, bear with us as we work through some of our staffing struggles. So definitely managers are having to work around the clock. There's many out there that haven't had a day off in ages because they want to make sure that their guests and customers are having a great experience.
So if you want to post a job or you want to find a job in the hospitality industry in Florida, go to greatfloridajob.com. It's free to job seekers and members of the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. If you're a non-member, you can post a job vacancy for a nominal fee. Check it out. Nicole Chapman, the Northeast Florida Regional Director and Florida Inns Chapter Director with the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. Thanks, Nicole.
Thank you.
And when we come back, an urban flower farm in the heart of historic Springfield is taking off. We'll take a closer look. That's after this. Don't go away.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com. Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community, featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and a life plan for every stage of aging. Information at vickerslanding.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley. Professional runner Nikki Hiltz shared their truth with the world recently by coming out as transgender after years of competing in women's events.
I almost got to a place where I started resenting my sport.
Now Hiltz could soon become one of the first openly transgender athletes at the Olympics. That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, the fight to uncover COVID-19's origins. We talk with Catherine Eban, who reports in Vanity Fair that those who pushed for transparency say toxic politics and hidden agendas prevented scientists from learning the origins of the virus and investigating whether a lab in Wuhan might have been the source. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Throughline is a podcast from NPR that goes back in time to help us better understand the present.
All we're seeing now is a churning, a political churning looking for an alternative.
We're teaming up to hear how the debates over free markets and the expectations we have of government are changing. Capitalism, kill or cure? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. They are an urban flower farm in the heart of historic Springfield. Soft Day Florals champions locally grown seasonal flowers without using any artificial herbicides or pesticides, and they avoid single-use plastics, too, as much as they can. For more about this unique business, I spoke with the company founder, Laura Graham.
Hi, Laura. Good to be with you. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I first learned of Soft Day Florals when I took a gardening tour several weeks ago of Riverside Avondale, and you had a spot on the tour. This is a great concept. Tell me about Soft Day Florals.
Yeah, so Soft Day Florals is an urban cut flower farm, and we're located in the historic district of Springfield, right here in Jacksonville, and we use sustainable practices to grow fresh seasonal flowers.
This is genius. I mean, that you're using open land in Springfield to do something really that provides not only beauty, but sustainability. How did you hit upon this? What got you into this?
Yeah, so it's quite a long tale, but basically I was working a pretty stressful job for a long time. I was a corporate lawyer for about 10 years. And I started gardening, you know, on the side as just a hobby to relieve the stress, and it spiraled. And I finally moved down here, and I found the land in Springfield. So I've partnered with a nonprofit called Sustainable Springfield to utilize the small lot to grow cut flowers. And so saving, one of our sort of missions is to save these vacant green spaces in our urban environment. Mm-hmm. You know, they sort of dot the city of Jacksonville, and I think they can be assets that can be put to use as gardens and farms.
Right. So you're killing a lot of birds with one stone, and you subscribe to what's called the Slow Flowers Movement. Can you explain what that is?
Absolutely. So I think the Slow Flowers Movement is having a real zeitgeist right now. So I think people maybe a decade ago started to realize this with respect to their food, that they could source it from local farmers who were growing more sustainably. And I think what people may not know about flowers is that the vast majority of flowers in the U.S. are imported from Colombia and also to a lesser degree Ecuador. And that means they're boxed up. They're cut, they're boxed up dry, they're wrapped in plastic. They don't see the light of day for days, maybe weeks. And the flowers are bred to withstand that journey. So they've lost their sense of romance and whimsy. They don't have the beautiful scent that flowers should have. And I think people are realizing that local flowers are just something different entirely.
Right. You're buying flowers that are grown locally. They're fresher. And so how can people access your product?
Yeah, so there's a couple different options. So we have bouquet subscriptions, which we started that people seem to love. So we did them in the spring. We have a summer one, which is
sold out currently. We may do a fall one, and certainly we'll do more next year. I often do porch pickups, which is really easy for people. They want a little pick-me-up, you know, in the middle of the week. We do pickups in Riverside, just out of my home. We, of course, do custom arrangements, bouquets, and also we do weddings and events. So we just launched our a la carte program, so that allows brides who are more, you know, they just want a bouquet and a boutonniere. They don't want the whole shebang. So that gives them just an easier, you know, more streamlined option.
And the Flower Farm is on Ionia Street in Springfield. It's not generally open to the public, right? But you can do photography sessions there. Is that something that you do?
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, for lots of fun reasons, we can't, you know, sort of generally allow the public in, but we do, you know, offer rates for photography sessions. You know, it's a really beautiful backdrop for people. And we can also do other, you know, private events there for, you know, teaching people how to grow flowers or simply doing tours of the farm.
This, and as I look at the website, I have to tell you, these are the most beautiful arrangements you will ever see. And you also have an interesting variety of flowers, Laura, that you might not see if you go into, say, you know, to pick up a bouquet at your neighborhood Publix. This is a more robust blend of blooms. Is that a good way to put it?
That is a perfect way to put it. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think part of my role, I think, is educating people. And so your flowers don't have to be, mums or roses that you pick up for $7.99 at Publix. You know, we grow lots of different really beautiful heirloom varieties. We grew in the spring, we grew sweet peas and ranunculus and anemones and foxglove. And I can't tell you the number of people that have said, oh my gosh, I didn't know you could grow foxglove here. Hmm. So there are some tricks to the trade of growing those things, and really the trick is planting them in the fall so they bloom in the spring. But we grow, yeah, a beautiful variety of flowers that are not, you know, grocery store flowers, I would say.
It is gorgeous. Check out Laura's website, softdayflorals.com, and learn about everything she's doing and order some blooms that are locally grown. Laura, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our editorial director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep those emails coming. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And catch our podcast up later today, wherever you like to listen. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. Take time to stop and smell the flowers.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.